Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of March. Our guest this hour, Rodessa Jones, describes herself as an actress of the oppressed. She believes in theater of the oppressed. And for many, many years now, she has used theater to transform the lives of incarcerated women and ex-offenders. She's worked with hundreds of women, primarily in the San Francisco area, but really has expanded her work all over the globe and has done significant work in South Africa. Her life story is amazing. She is one of 12 children, a daughter of migrant workers. She is co-artistic director of San Francisco's performance company, Cultural Odyssey, and she directs the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. She is doing other work. She's doing work on women who are HIV positive, and she started working with young people lately as well. We're delighted to have her with us. She is currently in Madison, and she is with the University of Wisconsin Arts Institute's Interdisciplinary Artist in Residence for 2014. She has been honored all over the country. She has done residencies all over the country. In San Francisco, she has been honored just last year as an artistic powerhouse whose work has transformed and saved lives. Rodessa, thank you so much for being with us. I've been looking forward to speaking with you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
And what a voice you have.
Thank you. I think that's part of the stage and then the anxiety with being an artist. Too many cigarettes at times.
But, that'll happen.
It works. It works.
It does. Yes. You know, I can't help but think that obviously you have a strong commitment to social justice, but I had this image in my mind of you working the fields with your parents, I mean, 12 mm-hmm. siblings, and you were singing. You were falling behind in your work because you and your siblings were singing Broadway show tunes.
Yes.
You had it in you a long time ago, huh?
Yes. Thank God for Ed Sullivan in America. Everybody got to enjoy a certain kind of commercial performance. And one of my siblings is Bill T. Jones, the choreographer.
Oh.
And it was he and I who'd get left behind a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, so you had that theater in you. But I love the fact that you have used it really to help people transform lives. And I'd like for you to start by talking a bit about how cultural experience and what you do can really, theater, creative arts, can change people's lives.
Well, you know, theater saved my life. I like to start there.
Sure.
I had a baby, you know. I had a baby at 16.
Mm-hmm.
And in upstate New York, where my mother and father had decided to settle so that we could get a better education and a better start in life. And I ended up being impregnated by a young guy and had this baby. And all of a sudden, it was like the world had come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
The songs in the fields, what was I going to do with my life? And I always say to women that I became a mother before I was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my brother Azel who introduced me to a theater company in upstate New York. And it was through that introduction and that interaction with that group of people that my life took on a whole nother kind of meaning. And I felt like I belonged somewhere. And I was a gopher. I used to stand in for other actresses. My daughter was there playing with the children of other hippies is basically what it was.
Aww.
You know.
Yeah.
And I was surrounded by other women who hadn't necessarily gotten married, but they were all doing theater. Everybody was engaged in painting the set, and the director was hugely pregnant, standing on a ladder, and her husband took care of the children. And this was like what they were doing, what they wanted to do. He was a wonderful guardian for the children, taking them into the yard, you know, making granola, making yogurt with them, taking care of the babies, and she was directing plays. And this was the beginning of my life in a lot of ways, and that I wasn't going to be a statistic, because I often tell people, you know, if it had not been for theater, I'd be no more than a memory or a girl, the B word, with a bad, bad attitude.
Right.
And it was theater that caught me and held me. And it was the applause and people wanting me to do well, because that's what I tell all of my students. Don't be so nervous about an audience. They want you to do well.
Yes, they do.
And then when you're working in a prison, you know, I've been working in prisons for the last It's almost 40 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and doing theater, theater that's about their stories. My job as the director is to come in and get them to open up and understand that we're all mythical creatures. You know, and you have to claim it all. You have to claim the scars, the anger, the sadness, the mistakes. And with my team, we help them to craft their stories, and then they go into a public space and tell their stories to the community. And I talk about the community as a part of the system of public communion, that we're all here to hear these daughters, these sisters, these mothers, these cousins. And it has empowered me as much as it has empowered them. But one thing I understand is that when you hear somebody's story, it changes your relationship to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes their relationship to you, you know, to actually talk about who we really are. You know, I love the whole feminist history in America, myself as a woman, as a daughter, the way women talk to each other now, what we share with each other, it's changed our relationships with each other. Yeah.
Yeah, it sure has. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine you have heard so many stories that are just hard to hear from incarcerated women. Just, they must hurt.
Yes. And the fury, you know, women, when I first come in to a space like prison or a juvenile hall or juvenile prisons. Like I work at one up in Alaska once in a while. The inmates are so angry. They're just seething. And especially women, you know, they're just so angry. And I watch it start to break down as I start to tell them my story. You know, Bob Dylan always said, I'll let you be in my dream.
Yes.
If I can be in your dream.
I love
dream.
That line.
Yeah,
right.
me too. And I say it to them. And they're like, wow, you know, it's like she's real and she's not come here to judge us, but to share with us, to share life with us. And I say to people, tell me what happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
Not what you think I should hear, but what do you think happened to your life? And I also remind them that you just might be able to save somebody else's life if we can get clear about where your life took a detour. And, you know, it's in sharing our stories again that women find a voice. You know, a lot of women, not just incarcerated women, but I am 65 years old, so it's like I've lived for the last 65 years in this country, and so much has happened. And we as women, we've taken it to the streets. I'm here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I have a theater workshop, and we're building a piece rooted in the new narratives for the 21st century.
Oh, great.
But the young people in the group, they love it when I just get real with them about where I've been, Woodstock, pot, you know, the whole thing. And they're sitting there. One kid said to me, gosh, I wish you were my grandma. Yeah.
And you'll just say, I will be as long as I'm here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
But I also tell them, you know, don't get it twisted. I'm a nice lady, but I'm a flamethrower as well. So.
Yes, you are.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I want to talk about drugs for a moment, because we've heard so much that so many people are in prison because of drug problems, because of selling drugs, that nonviolent offenses, but that it's huge. Is it huge with women in the prisons that you've been in?
Yes,
it is.
Yes, and it's racialized politics.
Mm.
You know, that's, you know, what else, you know, and it all began with the war on drugs, but the war on poverty also began this back in the era of Reagan. You know, I mean, now I'm not going to be naive and say that everybody who has been caught with drugs or, you know, who are incarcerated for drugs they're all innocent. No. But largely, the numbers are insanely high.
Right.
You know, and women, I think women get an extra slap on the wrist because, you know, we're back to the nature of the history of women. It's like we're supposed to be home, not seen or heard. And here, women are out in the streets in such large numbers. And when I first started going into the prisons to make theater for incarcerated women, that's when I noticed the numbers were growing with women being incarcerated. And a lot of it was because if you were there when he got busted, then you were implicated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's a lot of those sad stories. I mean, stories of college girls coming home for the holidays. I met one young woman, and she talked about coming home for Easter, and her brother sent her over to a mutual friend's house to pick up a package. I mean, she'd just come from Grambling University in Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
and she had no idea. She's up there, you know, talking to this friend, and next thing you know, the doors crashed in, the police are there, and she has this package in her purse.
Mm-hmm.
And boom. So I meet her, and instead of going back to school, she's facing going to court, and right now this young lady had to do... hopefully she's out now, but at that point, that time in space, she was doing 2 to 5 years for possession of a substance, and it was cocaine.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. So totally innocent, but the police are like, yeah, right. Is that what you're calling it now? I'm just here picking this up for my brother,
mm-hmm.
you know. And also, it all depends on the skin you're living in. She's a black girl, you know. It was a black guy, yeah. So back to your question, yes, the numbers are incredibly high. And I think that we as a nation has to say, now, wait a minute. We could use this money in a lot of other ways, especially for victimless crimes where people are picked up with marijuana, you know. And sometimes I feel like it's a quota, you know. An officer has to go out and do a quota, pick up so many people. You know, that's how racialized it is, and that's how corrupt it is, you know. Yeah.
When you talk about getting people over the bridge from the prison back to the community,
mm-hmm.
how do you get them from the jail over the bridge? How do you walk over the bridge?
It's the performance, the whole process. When I first started this work, it was 4 to 6 months in the county jail. And I say that was my training as an artist working in an institution like jail or prison. So Mike Hennessy, who was the county sheriff, has since retired, but God bless you, Mike, wherever you are. He believed in the power of art. So we were given the room to work with women. So I taught everything from stage presence to playwriting to simply standing up straight and being heard to mask making to dance.
Mm.
I taught all of this in a 4 to 6 month period. So the women had all this training. And on top of that, Sean Reynolds, who was a social worker, who helped founded the Medea Project, she was there to talk about the realities of life. You know, simply, what are we going to do about our children? How are we going to stop coming to jail? You know, how are we going to get help? What are we going to do about our aging parents who are left to take care of our children while we are in lockdown?
Yes.
So we got all of this coming at this group of artists, performers, prisoners. And as I said, they start to find their voices. And so by the time you get to the stage, they've already been empowered through techniques of theater, improvisational theater, storytelling. And then the audience is, God bless San Francisco, but Martha Graham said that people from California believe anything's possible. So the audiences would just be so there for the women. So here you are about mid-bridge. Right. And then the show happens. The sheriff would give us sometimes a 2-week run. The women would come out of jail under lock and key every night, and they would do these fantastic shows, reviews, the whole thing. And then we'd have a major party inside. Oh, I'm sorry. The gala would happen, and the gala could have everybody from the mayor to the sheriff himself, to social workers, to record producers, because you have these people with amazing talent.
I imagine.
Yeah, and this is the gala, and we would encourage them, talk to these people. Talk to them about how to get back to your dream. Beauticians, clothing designers, all these people would be there at the gala. So it would be like a trade show of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And the women were given another hour to hang out. The sheriff would say they could hang out after the show for another hour. And they get to talk about where they were going, what they were doing, what they hoped to do. And then they'd go back to the jail and we'd have a big party. And everybody would get to debrief about what happened. Who did they meet? What are they feeling like?
Wonderful.
And there are women next week here at UW-Madison, Angela Wilson is coming. She's an ex-offender that I met about 14 years ago in the county jail in San Francisco. She'll be coming to the campus to talk about her work with the Medea Project.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I know you're also doing, you're doing so much, but you also, I have read, are shifting some of your focus now to a younger generation, you say, hoping to help them through theater before they reach a point where it's too late. Mm-hmm. How are you doing that?
Well, I'm invited everywhere. Everywhere.
That's nice.
And here at Madison, actually, the group of students I have, they're amazing. I mean, these are like, they're like the creme de la creme. I mean, here they are in school, you know, and they find me because they want to explore artist activism. But even more so, I am constantly being sought out to go into children's prisons. There's a lot of children's prisons around now. You know, if mothers and fathers are going to jail in large numbers, what's happening to children?
Right.
And so I get to work with them inside and, you know, just get to talk to them about who they are, who they want to be. And I was up in Alaska, and there was all these children wanting to do slam poetry, you know, and that one boy was probably 17, and he was in lockdown. And he did this wonderful poem using the phone as a prop. And it was all about, when are you coming home? And I thought, of course, it was the girlfriend or something. And I said, wow, that was a lovely poem. What a! I said, God, you'd be the kind of guy I'd want to hang out with. He said, that was to my mom. He said, my mom left. My mom moved back to Seattle and left us here in Anchorage. Mm. And he said, and then I got all caught up with my friends because going home was hard. And he said, and my mom will call once in a while. But he said, I don't think she's ever coming back to be with us. And his father was doing hard time. And this was a young white male. Uh-huh. You know, that's what's trippy. This was a young white boy who was just devastated that his mother had abandoned them, you know. And I was trying to help him to understand what might be going on with his mom and the fears that she has. And he says, but what's going to happen to me and now my brothers and sisters? You know, and that's a real question, you know, in this country right now.
Those poetry slams have really taken off, haven't they, Rodessa?
Yes,
I've heard
yes.
some young people give poems that just leave me speechless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where we are, you know, I'm moved that I was that last generation that helped to clear away. You know, I just directed Sekou Sendiata's Blessing the Boats. And Sekou Sendiata, he has passed on now, but an amazing spoken word artist. And they called him the Marvin Gaye of spoken word. So I got to peruse his language in New York and met a lot of really fantastic poets. But then last week here on the campus of UW, last Friday, was it? Oh, goodness. There was something called Moonshine, Chris Walker's. He's a choreographer in the dance department. Those children, everything from Trayvon Martin to Love and Loss. Oh, it was stunning. It was just stunning work. And the movement, the dance was stunning. But I think they're our children. It's what we've spawned. You know, so of course they should be. You know, I have a granddaughter. She's 24. And she's on the medical track. She wants to be a doctor. But she keeps me abreast of who's hip and who's in and who's not, you know? So, yeah.
Isn't that amazing? You have a 24-year-old granddaughter because you were mom so young, right?
Yes.
That's remarkable.
Yes.
And I want to spend a few moments before we invite the audience. You've made some comparisons. You've done a lot of work in South Africa as mm-hmm. well, and I had read that you described the prison conditions as being very different in Johannesburg than they are in this country, that
yes.
women don't have to wear uniforms, that children can stay with their moms until they're 5 or 6.
Yes.
What difference does it make in helping women cross that bridge back to the community if the prison conditions are more humane?
Well, you know, it's a juggling act, because inside, it's amazing for a baby to be able to see its mom whenever it wants to. You know, the baby's born into prison, but the baby doesn't know it was born into prison. It just knows that that comfort of the mother is there. Now, that's great. But the mother still has to deal with, on the outside, trying to get a job, you know, trying to get some sort of employment so that she can reclaim her child. Now, the prison, what it does there, which I admire incredibly, is that they will keep this baby until it's 5 or 6 because they're looking for a family. They're looking for blood relatives to take this child while the mother does her time. But the mother can end up back at home, and there's no room for her because the parents have taken her baby, or his family has taken her baby, and they're taking care of it. And they'll just, you know, she has to get a job immediately. And it's still hard to be employed once you've spent downtime. But the prisons are so much more human, one, I think, because of the races and the language. The Zulu is the largest group in South Africa, but there's 6 or 7 other dialects and languages, and everybody speaks some English. And there is a community feeling amongst the guards and the prisoners that's different than here and in America. You know, we're so into you are guilty until you've done your time,
right.
You know,
right.
And we're not really. I've had a lot of struggle with just keeping my art alive in prisons in America because a lot of authorities just don't get it. You know, they don't. Why should these people have fun? You know, and the other side of it, of course, is that the person is opening up and growing and turning into a possible futuristic energy that could be of some use to the culture. But a lot of people see theater, art, dancing, even the rehearsals where women are laughing and jumping and rolling as having fun, and they should be punished.
Mm-hmm.
Where South Africa, it's really about helping a person to deal with their time with as much dignity and light as possible. And also, since in the prisons in South Africa, with the advent of HIV growing so immensely, there's all kinds of courses around, peer courses around how do you start an orphanage. They're trying to figure that out in South Africa. How do peer counselors find, how do you learn to be one to speak about HIV, to be of assistance, to even be a chaplain is another thing that you can train for in the prisons in South Africa. And the air is just much, is much richer there,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
than here in America. But I think that restorative justice is becoming a global movement. So I think things will change to some degree, at least with women here in the U.S.
Rodessa Jones is our guest this hour, joining us by from our studios in Madison. And she is at UW-Madison 2014, the University of Wisconsin Arts Institute's Interdisciplinary Artist in Residence for the year. She has been working for just a number of years in prisons in various parts of this country and in South Africa. She conducts media projects in South African prisons, works in jails and educational institutions literally all over the world. She is co-artistic director of San Francisco's performance company, Cultural Odyssey, and she is director of the Medea Project Theater for Incarcerated Women, committed to incarcerated women's personal and social transformation. Here's how you can reach our conversation if you'd like to. You may just want to listen to her extraordinary story, but I'm sure some of you may want to participate. So here's how you do it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls and emails and all kinds of ways for you to get a hold of our guest this hour, Rodessa Jones. 800-486-8655, our number. Ruth is calling us from Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. And what an awesome program this sounds like. I have a friend who is currently in the 19th year of a life sentence for a murder she did not commit. And so we're working on getting her exonerated. We finally got some DNA to test and got the possibility to test it. And what I wanted to say mostly is you just can't understand the misery that's in the prison. And people don't understand that it isn't just your freedom you've lost for this time you've been incarcerated, but any job you might have held with Social Security earnings put aside, you know, that's all gone. So you can't retire at 65. But I wanted to say that the arts programs in Madison and Milwaukee, the students could pair with like the Madison Urban Ministry and whatever Milwaukee's counterpart is, because they do reentry fairs and reentry reenactments, and they're frequently seeking people to play the part of potential employers, and you know the parts of other people in the community, potential landlords and stuff, to so that people will see what returning incarcerated people, what returning prisoners are facing when they come back into the community.
Regessa.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely, your friend, is she incarcerated around here?
90 miles away at Tichita. Okay. It's the only women's prison in Wisconsin.
Because I've been so impressed with the outreach here in Madison. I've met Reverend G, I think it is. There's a beautiful lady chaplain. I mean, I'm just impressed with the interaction of the community and the prisons in this area of the world. There's something very progressive about it, as well as it is the inmates themselves who I met a couple of people who actually have done time, and now they're actually doing community service. There's a gentleman, his first name is Jerome, wonderful, wonderful person. And so this is a really good place to be, and I wish your friend the best of luck, and you're absolutely right about housing and jobs. We need people to step forward and say, yes, I would still give somebody that break, you know, once they get out, because all that stuff is lost. It is totally lost when you're in lockdown, as well as, oh my goodness, to not have done the crime. That's just maddening. It's just utterly maddening.
Yeah.
And I wish her the best.
Thank you, Ruth. Thanks very much for the call. And there's the rub, isn't it? Because people get out of prison. I mean, the vast majority of people get out, and I think that we are woefully letting them down, because what kind of life can you build if you don't have people who are helping you to rebuild? Mm-hmm. You've got to have support, right?
Yes. And, well, you know, what's going on in California, which is pretty horrific, is the three strikes.
Right.
And so then you're in lockdown. But if you get out of prison and you cannot live any longer if your grandmother's in public housing, and you go to live with your grandmother, and then you you commit some other crime, your grandmother loses her space, you know. And so I'm just in response to how can we prepare people to come back out and live in the world, because there's so much self-governance that has to happen. You know, and it's hard, because back to racialized politics, it's designed to fail. And at the same time, the people that could help you, they're totally in jeopardy, you know. And it's usually, I'm a grandmother. I mean, I'm going to be here for my granddaughter, and I would hope that she would be aware of that. But in California, the elderly will lose their homes, their subsidized housing, if a grandson or a granddaughter is living with them and commits another crime, or even if the authorities find out that this person is living there.
Right.
Yeah. And the weight of it all. It's how do we help our brothers and sisters, our community that's inside? It's one of the big questions of the 24th century, to 21st, 24th, Lord help us.
Who knows about the 24th?
but the 21st century, as we move into a new day, what are we going to do, you know, to open these the doors of the prisons and let people go that are only there because of you know, a drug misdemeanors.
Nonviolent
crimes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What, this must really break your heart in some ways, Rodessa, when you see, when you were describing it, I haven't seen any of the performances, but they're in my mind now as we're talking, and I'm seeing all this great talent, you know, great costume making and this acting going on and singing and dancing, all of these wonderful talents that you bring forward from from the prisoners. And you must say to yourself every darn day, if only those were unleashed when they were, you know, 12 and 13 and 14 and 15. And I guess the question outside prison is, how do we do that? All these women probably could have had, they have all these talents that could have made contributions to society.
And some of them did. You know, I worked for several years off and on with Paulette Jones, and Paulette Jones had been one of Tom O'Horgan's favorite actresses on Broadway, you know, Hair. Mm. Paulette did these shows, a fabulous singer, natural piano player, but she was so embittered that art could not save her, she'd say.
Mm.
She said, look at me. Mm-hmm. Art cannot save me. And it was like, and now she's actually living in a senior housing in Sacramento, California, and she's on dialysis and that kind of stuff. But, you know, you're right about looking at younger people. And the real Roxanne, who was an early rapper, I met in the prison in San Francisco. You know, and with women, see, it's like, and we think about Charles Dutton, Ben Gazzara, these men did time, you know, and then came out to be stars. I don't know that many women who are either coming clean, that there is, what is the show, The New Orange is Black or The New Black
Red,
is Orange?
Yeah.
That young lady and her story and actually it becoming a part of television history. But I think that it has to do with opening a way for people. And also, they've got to live until they can even get the big break. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And by then, as Sean Reynolds would say, if you don't have any money, you're going to get some. And women, you know, a lot of women, the backstory is prostitution, robbery, actually burglaries. This kind of stuff is the backstory. And how do we sustain them? I worked with HUD for a while, more than 20 years ago, on trying to set up a system, a program, where women getting out of jail could live in public housing with their children. But a lot of women, they would always end up bringing a man on board, and then you lose your housing, you know, and then they're embittered even more. So it's when I work with women, I start now by speaking about their right to a life, and trying to make it clear that this is just not a show, but it's about finding a way back to your family. Your children need you,
right?
You know, as I said, Angela Wilson is going to come. I have a theater company in San Francisco, and there's about 5 or 6 ex-offenders who've been in and around the project all these years. And so I'm glad of that, but it's not enough. It's not enough women to come back and work with me with the idea that they're going to save their own lives through the theatrical process.
Well, they can use the theatrical process to perhaps save their lives and then move into gainful employment and full lives somehow. Mm-hmm. Somehow.
Well, you know, we pay cultural honesty. We are a major community. The Medea Project is a major community project, and bless the city of San Francisco, bless the funding sources in California, that there are monies, the hotel tax fund, that when we do a series of shows, women can make, I mean, you're not going to make multitudes of dollars, but you do make money for rehearsal time, for the performance time, because we realize that I get paid as an artist.
Sure.
You know, so that's what we're doing, and hopefully we're influencing other people who are working with folks, quote, from the marginal communities.
Yeah. I'm interested, if you don't mind, just because I find your life story so extraordinary as well, to have 12 siblings, they really caught my eye, 12 siblings, and to be working in the field, your parents being migrant workers. Tell me what happened to your siblings. You have a famous choreographer brother. Was life open for most of your siblings? Did they have rough times?
Well, I think it was just what happens with a large group of people. My mother had 19 pregnancies.
Ah! Oh.
12 of us lived.
Wow.
My brother Richard was at Attica when Rockefeller sent in the goon squad.
Oh, he was?
Yes. My brother Richard was like, when my mother married my dad, she had 4 children. And my brother Richard was the baby. And I think he kind of got caught up in this psychological maelstrom of where do I belong? Who do I belong to? Mm-hmm. Because my mother and father got together and they just started having babies. And Richard ended up on the chain gang,
oh,
like 18, 19 years old. But he was one of the sadder stories. Largely, folks grew up, had their families, raised them. All of my older siblings have died now. You know, they're all gone. Janie, Harris, Roosevelt, Richard, they're all gone now. And it's Irie, who is the oldest one of my mother and father's biological children. He is my oldest brother, the oldest one living now. And we're doing okay, but they kind of shied away from the theater. Everybody's very talented. But the other side is that either you're a writer or a producer, a singer, or you are a banker. and you know,
of course.
and there are people in the family who went that way. But you know, as you're talking, I realize, gosh, we're all old people now. Mm. It's like I would have responded very differently 20 years ago.
Right.
But because everybody was dibbling and dabbling still in theater and singing and producing plays and that kind of thing. But no, we did okay. But my mother insisted, you know, my mother said, you know, you have to at least finish high school. You have to finish high school. And my father said, you got to work, because if you don't work, you'll steal. Mm-hmm. And if you steal, I'm a poor man. I can't help you.
Mm-hmm.
This was the ongoing rant, the ongoing diatribe, the chant. And, you know, and so we've all arrived at this place. But my mother and father both were great storytellers. They were wonderful storytellers.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
And you talk about theater saving you in New York. But then, how did doing theater work in prison, how did that come about?
I had already developed a reputation for making autobiographical theater.
I see.
One of my world-class pieces is something entitled The Legend of Lily Overstreet. And The Legend of Lily Overstreet I made in 1979, and it's about new dancing in America. Because I worked in a peep show. I had to pay for my daughter's incidentals at a private school. And so I got this job in a peep show, and I made a performance about it. And yes, I know. the kids get a kid. The students here love talking about it.
I bet they do.
Yeah. And so the California Arts Council gave me a call. And they asked me, would I be interested in going into the prisons and teaching aerobics? Because I was also, by this time, I was very involved with a dance company, Tumbleweed. Mm. And Tumbleweed, the founder, Teresa Dickinson, was a member of the Twyla Tharp Dance Company.
Oh, sure.
And Teresa moved to California and decided she wanted to work in a more collective way. So I was doing that. And I got this call, would I go in and teach aerobics to incarcerated women? And I was fascinated. I said, well, sure. You know, like, you know, I don't know what it had to do with rehabilitation, but I went. thus this all began. You know, they didn't want to exercise. That was simply what the California Arts Council, who had been the agency that gave me the call, they couldn't figure out a better. They knew women, the numbers for women being incarcerated was growing so rapidly. They were trying to think of what they could do, and so bless their hearts, they thought, we'll share aerobics with them. You know, Jane Fonda was happening around the same
time.
Right,
right.
And so I went in, and I'm not an aerobics teacher. I mean, I'm a physical theater performer and an aerialist and all that. But I went in, and it just really touched my heart, you know, that so many women were in jail and so many women looked like me, black and brown women, just sitting there like stone, you know, and I thought, wow, you know, and I began to talk about my life. I began to talk about my narrow escapes with men, my dance, you know, my dance with drugs. I mean, I did all that. I was a hippie girl, you know, and looking for love in all the wrong places. And they would look at me, you know, I would, because I'd be cartwheeling and backbending and doing splits and standing on my hands as I talked about turning 42, and my daughter had just gotten married, and I was excited about the possibility of a grandbaby, and they're looking at me. And one woman said, "Why are you telling us your business?"
Ooh.
Yeah, and which African-American woman. And I said, no, she said, "Are you the police?" And I said, "No. I'm an artist who's dreaming of ways and means of building a bridge that's going to take us out of here. Hopefully we can close jails." And she said, "Then you're not the police." I said, "No." I said, "I'm an artist."
Oh.
And she said, "What's that?" And so I've been attempting to answer that for the rest of my life. What is an artist in this kind of a situation? What can an artist do to make somebody else's life a little bit better? You know, how can we share art with oppressed and oppressed people and the people in lockdown? Art is so magical, you see. It's and it's a safe place to tell stories, and you know, and it's a safe place to fall. You know, I'm one of the things that I do even here at UW is we have all these exercises for falling and catching each other and picking each other up, you know, because I've been in some situations where people are telling these blood-curdling stories about survival or betrayal, and they can't stand. And I said to Spirit when it first happened to me, I said, "Spirit, tell me what to do," because I thought maybe I'd crossed a line, you know. This woman could hardly breathe. And Spirit said, "Have the group lift her up, lift her up." So it's something we do now in wherever I'm working.
Right.
It becomes a part of the physical warm-up to lay hands on people and to lift
and
them
to
up.
And to lift them up, yeah. Rodessa Jones is our guest this hour. She, well, it's hard to say all she does because she's doing a lot, but she's been using theater primarily to transform lives of incarcerated women and ex-offenders in California and all over the country. She's done residencies. She does performance shows in New York. She's director as well. She works a great deal in South Africa. And the question that we're addressing is, what is it an artist can do to lift people up, to make changes, significant changes, in the lives of people who are pretty beaten up? Join us if you'd like. It may be the kind of show that you just want to listen to, but if you want to answer that question, we'd love to hear your answer as well. Our phone number in the minutes remaining, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Rodessa is founder and director of the Medea Project, and she is right now the University of Wisconsin Arts Institute's Interdisciplinary Artist in Residence for 2014. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls for Rodessa Jones, the role of artists in making the world better and in working with people, incarcerated people specifically, is what Rodessa has been doing for a number of years now and has received all kinds of awards for her remarkable contribution to humanity, really. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we go to Eric, who's listening in South Carolina. Hi, Eric.
Hi, hello.
Hi, go right ahead, sir.
Oh, yes. I was just going to say, after listening to your show, that I can remember when I was in the Army a long time ago, there were several folks who were in there that were given the option of, you know, 10 years in jail or 6 years in the Army and things like that. And that is something I wish they did a lot more of nowadays. If some kid stole a car, he's 19, sold a bag of pot or something, I'd much rather have him in the Army or help him to clean an aircraft carrier than sitting in jail. Mm. And there never was a, I don't remember a single problem with any of those people while I was in. They often were tickled to be in the Army, and it would do them a lot of good.
What do you think about that, Rodessa?
I think it's, you're talking about a time when we really understood human rights are also, prisoners' rights. It's, I think human rights is like the dignity of our country, you know, when we're at our best. That makes total sense to me. It makes total sense to me. I grew up in a household where men were always encouraged to, if they were feeling their oats, young men, I would hear this, that you should join the service. Join the service. You can go to school. You can get three meals a day. I totally understand that, period. And, gosh, I wish it was still around. I wish it was an option. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Eric, for the call.
Thank you, Eric.
Steve in Iowa. Hi, Steve.
Yes, I just had a question. Of the people she thought should probably let go for minor offenses or whatever, who would those people be? And secondly, how many times do you think they committed the crime before they got caught?
Well, I think that, the definition of crime becomes distorted. If somebody leaves a party, and this has happened to my granddaughter in Georgia, where she lives, she and her boyfriend, they leave a party. They have a bud in a plastic bag in the car. The police is just sitting waiting to stop people because I think it's a quota. And so the police stops you, and they had some legal struggles with having a bud in their car, you know. And it wasn't like committing the crime as often, but it was just that at that moment they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Then I'm talking about victimless crimes like that. I'm not talking about pounds of marijuana even. That's a whole – well, in California it's very different now, in Colorado. But I'm talking about people who are simply, you know, out with a half a gram or even a gram of pot. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. And if somebody has committed the crime, it would have to be examined. Was it always being stopped by the police and having a little bit of pot, or was it something bigger? You know, I'm talking about people that are kind of caught off guard because they figure nobody's going to care that I have a bud or two in my purse, that kind of a thing, yeah.
Thanks, Steve, for the call. Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. My grandmother, when I was a little boy, I remember her saying to a neighbor who said, I just want my kids to be happy. Mm-hmm. And my grandma said, well, when I was growing up in Goodrich, Michigan, the question wasn't how can I be happy? It was how can I be of use to my society, my community? Mm-hmm. And I would just say, Rodessa Jones, I think in the part of the broadcast that I had a chance to catch, your life is a life that is of use to the community and particularly to those least served by that community. And I just wanted to thank you for your example. Mm.
Thank you for your kind words. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl, so much. We only have about a minute left. Are we going to have people who live in other parts of the state a chance to see you perform or your students perform or... What about that?
We're performing here.
Okay.
May 5th at the Mitchell Theater here on the campus of University of Wisconsin at Madison with my group.
Great.
The class that I'm teaching here is entitled Forward Motion, New Narratives for the 21st Century. So I'm working with students from various schools here on campus, and we're going to make a major work. And my partner, Idris Akamore, will fly in from California and help compose the music. So that's happening here. And, I may very well be in New York in the fall to do something, but I have to head out for Africa Because I, you know, I have, I have a company in Africa now.
Oh,
you know,
my gosh, Rodessa.
Yeah, yeah, so, and I'm very excited about that. But no, for now, we will be here in Madison in May performing, and I'll perform, Idris perform, and the children, not the children, sorry, gang, the young folks here on campus will perform as well.
Oh, it sounds terrific. Yes. We'll mark that down. Send us more information, and we'll announce it again.
Okay,
and
thank you,
Rodessa, so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Rodessa Jones, the founder and director of Medea Project Theater for Incarcerated Women. She is University of Wisconsin Arts Institute's Interdisciplinary Artist in Residence for 2014. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour and KP Whaley for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We're with you again tomorrow. And tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we'll try and figure out what all is going on in Ukraine and with Russia and with the United States. That will be one of our programs tomorrow, and we hope that you will listen. Great conversations ahead. Thanks very much for being a part of today's discussions. And we have news coming up momentarily, and then stay tuned for Central Time. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.